Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com. By VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop. RunCatalina.com, the Catalina Marathon coming up on Saturday, March 10th. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, last year we sent out 2,448 grants, totaling $3.7 million. Keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. That's challengedathletes.org. And you can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here. Our next guest, one of our favorite people on the planet, Colonel David Rozelle. David, how the heck you doing?
Hey, doing great. Glad to be back in the USA after 4 years of being an expatriate in Korea.
So when we first started chatting back in, what, 04, 05, you were
04.
What? Yeah, what were you, a sergeant? What the hell were you, a major? I mean, you have been...
I was just a baby captain back in those days.
You were captain, and then major, and then colonel. You have been a busy guy.
Yeah, it's been a busy 14 years since I met you for both of us. But the Army career continues on, and still trying to do multi-sport to keep myself in shape and from going crazy.
I love it. So, June 21st, 2003, you're in Heat, Iraq, I think.
And that's right.
You were Captain David Rozelle at that point. And you're in the Humvee. And at that point... I read something that there was pretty much a bounty out on you, correct?
Yeah, that's right. No, I was having a lot of success. I was a troop commander in that region, and I was reestablishing a local government, and I was already doing some unique things. Like, I put a woman on the city council, which upset a lot of people. So in a short amount of time, I was shutting down the black market. People wanted to kill me, and that probably not the first time in my life that someone's wanted to kill me, but certainly they intended to do it there.
And so there was a bounty on you, like $1,000.
Yeah, it was only $1,000. I actually offered $10,000 to whoever could kill me. probably not very smart in hindsight, but it seemed like a good idea.
So on June 21st, what do you remember from, or do you remember anything?
Yeah, no, I remember the whole event. Unfortunately, it was very, that was one of the hardest things to get over, was that it was such a clear memory in me. But, you know, it's going down a road I've been down a million times, and I was, going to teach a police academy, which was kind of a new thing for me. It was a big deal. The regional sheik was going to be there. The new city council would be there. It was going to be a great image of success in Iraq and the new Iraq and the future of what lay ahead. And unfortunately, en route, I noticed that the route that we took, the road had been turned up, and I told my driver to stop. I looked around. And I said, man, something's really different. Of course, it was different because I'd... there were some landmines out there. It was actually 8 landmines. And as we moved forward again, right, we rolled right over a landmine. It blew off the front end of my Humvee and took my right foot with it.
So you're bleeding arms, legs, face. Within 2 hours, you're in Baghdad Hospital. What were your doctor gave you a couple of options. It was like one of those things where one option is, and the other option is, no, that doesn't quite work.
Yeah, no, the option was to, you know, initially, you know, you met with the surgeon, and, you know, I'll never forget waiting for him to come talk to me, and some mortar rounds hit nearby the hospital tent, and you could just see the dust, you know, coming off the roof of the tent when the mortar rounds hit nearby, and I thought, my God, they're going to do surgery on me here, and then the surgeon came over, and he said, you know, we could kind of put something back together that looks like a foot, and you'd be a cripple the rest of your life, or we can cut it off and make you an amputee. And my simple question was, will I be able to run again? And he said, if you become an amputee, you probably will. So it was a pretty easy decision. As an athlete, I didn't want to be a cripple.
Right.
So I figured I'd take my chances as an amputee.
So basically, with a prosthetic, there was possibilities. Without a prosthetic, you have a club foot and really be able to do nothing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and there's some guys that have found a way to kind of get over the club foot, but I didn't want to take the chance. You know, it was probably, you know, it was a quick decision, and I was very tired and angry. And honestly, Bob, I just wanted them to fix me so I could go back and fight. And that's a strange mentality you have when you're a young person, you know.
Well, especially when you're a leader, right? You feel like you've left your men, and you want to get back.
Right.
There.
I'd only been in country. It's kind of embarrassing. I'd only been in country about 3 months. You know, I'd been only in Iraq for I think two at that point. So we were just really getting going, and I was having success. And I promised all those families of those soldiers, their moms and dads, and brothers and sisters, and wives and kids, that I'd bring everybody home. And then there I was. We had a couple other injuries and fatalities, but there I was, pretty much the first to go home. And it made me sick. And I thought I'd never see the Army again. I thought I'd never command again, and that was terrifying.
So you go to Walter Reed. You were basically a 220-pound rugby guy. Now, while you're there, you're down to what, 170 or so?
Yeah, once I broke the 180 mark, so down to 175, 179, depending on how much I ate. But, I hadn't been that since, like, junior high school. So I was sick and, was having trouble eating, was over-medicated, and it was very foggy. And, that's before we had these centers of excellence where you took care of people at places like Walter Reed or Center for the Intrepid. But none of that existed. You got your final surgeries, you got shipped off to go home, become a member of the VA, and you start a new life. And, when they handed me my paperwork to become a veteran, I threw it in the trash right in front of the guy and said, "No, man, I'm going back to war. I don't know who you are, but this is not stopping me. I'm going to get back after it." So I sort of broke a mold doing that.
So Mom comes to the hospital, and I remember a story where she reminded you about a running event that you had done when you were younger, where you're 2 miles to go and things were tough, and Mom came up and said, "Hey, we'll do this together." And she reminded you of that because she basically was saying, "We're going to do this together. We're going to get you past this." How important was that?
Yeah, it was unfortunate. Kim was 9 months pregnant, or 8 months pregnant at the time with Forrest, my oldest son.
Yeah.
My first son, and so she wasn't able to fly out, and leaving Colorado to D.C. was not a possibility. So Mom raced up, and it was the 4th of July, I'll never forget, and she walked in, and she was the first, and that was a very powerful moment. And she just said, "Hey, we're in this together, just like when I got you across that finish line when you were sick before, I'll get you across the finish line again." And that's a powerful that's a powerful memory you just invoked. I almost forgot about that. I'm in tears now, man. You're crushing me. Nice job.
Well, when you get to Fort Collins, you get home, and you're trying to deal with life as an amputee, and you've got real pain and phantom pain, and you've got cramps in parts of your body that don't exist anymore, and you're doing a little self-medicating. Morphine is what's there every 2 hours or so. You got your alarm set. And I remember you telling me at that point, I wasn't a good husband. I wasn't a good father. I was staying up late. I woke up and watching TV all day. Then a letter arrived at the house. And talk a little bit about what was in that letter and how that changed everything.
Yeah, it was a very difficult time in my life because I'd sort of lost control. Because they changed it now. They've got a much better system. The military medical system is so much better. But I was sent home with a giant bag of drugs.
Yeah.
And I would just experiment every day with different cocktails and concoctions to see what made the pain go away. And it was, it just changed me. I wasn't myself. I was stoned all the time and drunk all the time. And it was just a horrible, horrible time. And here we were, waiting on our son to come any day, and I was no help to my wife, even after my son was born. And then I crunched out to the mailbox one day and got a letter and looked at it, and I said, "Wow, that looks like my handwriting." And sure enough, it was the last letter I would have sent my wife. And as I was tearing it open and reading it with tears in my eyes, the neighborhood kids were laughing at me and making fun of my missing leg. And I remember just thinking, this is the absolute bottom I can get right now. Unfortunately, my bottom was a lot higher than most people when they sort of reached the bottom. But seeing those words from myself and telling my family about how proud I was to be deployed and how important it was and what we were doing, and the fact that those would have been the last words that my wife would have read, and maybe even be the last thing that she carried with the rest of her life and read to our son that would have survived, it changed me. It made me think, you know, of course, it didn't happen overnight, but it said, I got to get it together, and it was time. And that's when it all started, man. That's when I said, this is it. I'm gonna become a new Dave Rozelle, and it happened right then.
At that point, had any soldiers or troops who had lost a limb in battle come home, got a prosthetic, and gone back?
Not to the same battlefield. I was the first to do that. I mean, that was kind of the historic moment. Of course, I didn't realize it until after I'd done it.
Right.
It was really just to get back to with my troops, and it wasn't until after someone had researched it and said, hey, you know, you're the first, Dave, since the Civil War, for the commander to return to the same battlefield as an amputation. It's the old days, they'd patch him back up, like General Hood in
yes.
the Civil War. They'd throw him on a saddle and sort of strap his stump to the horse. Of course, we call it hippotherapy today, but back then he had to continue to command. You know, they couldn't afford to lose a general in those days, and I felt the same way. I really felt like just patch me up and get me back to the fight, and I did. And within 12 months of returning to Fort Carson, I took command again. Within 18 months, I was back in Iraq as a cavalry troop commander, doing all the reconnaissance for the Battle of Talifar, which was a pretty important battle back in 2005.
So you go from, you know, again, basically stopping the morphine cold turkey, you're 1 minute of jumping a rope to 15 minutes, and obviously you're thinking, okay, I've got to pass the physical, right, to get back, to be able to be allowed to go back. This is uncharted territory. People, when they get injured like that and they come home, it's almost okay, I did my duty, I gave for my country, and now I'm out. That never entered your mind. You were always thinking, I'm going back. How hard was it physically? Because, you know, you've got to show that you've got to pass all the tests, and now you're missing a limb below the knee. How hard was it?
Well, to all the great physical therapists out there, I got very lucky. I got a young woman, a young captain, my same rank at the time, named Dana Koval. She's out there somewhere in the world. She's involved in multi-sport now, too. But she's just come from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, had been treating as a lieutenant all these young men that had been jumping out of airplanes. And so she told me, hey, Dave, I don't know what I'm doing necessarily with you as an amputee, but let's not think of you as an amputee anymore. Let's just think of you as having, like, a severe ankle, knee, and back injury. And let's just take you from start all the way to back to being able to deploy, and you can pass your physicals. Get back onto active duty, which I was on active duty, but I was kind of in a timeout. You know, I had about 6 months where, you know, I was doing administrative work, and they gave me all the time I needed to go. I had some great leadership to go to all my appointments and everything. And Dana, man, she crushed my soul. I mean, she and I would go to the gym and we'd work out like 2 hours a day. And, you know, she made me not want to go home and have a beer because, you know, I needed to rehydrate. And, of course, it was at altitude, and, you know, she and another woman, a wife of a soldier who was deployed, taught me into doing my first triathlon, and I did this crazy midwinter triathlon there in Colorado Springs.
Pueblo Tri?
Yeah, and it was there's snow on the ground, and, you know, I did the swim and indoor pool, and then we did a mountain bike, and a lot of people wiped out because it was snow everywhere still, and then on the run, my goal was just to finish. Just wanted to walk from start to finish without quitting. And it was the slowest time I've ever run in my life of any race. But you know what? I was a champion at the finish line. And that was the beginning of it. I realized, you know what? I can do this.
Well, and you are on a walking leg.
I was on some horrible, you know, 8-pound stiff foot, you know. I think he even had like a hiking boot on or something. And it was horrible. It was the hilly. I was hurting. I got done, and, you know, of course I went and had like a cheeseburger and a beer because I didn't understand how your diet affected fitness back in those days.
Nobody
but,
did.
So, it was great. I mean, that was the beginning. That was the beginning of everything. It was awesome.
And then October 2014, you do the 1.2-mile swim at San Diego Triathlon Challenge. Now, how did you find out about CAF?
Yeah, I actually got a phone call from one of your great employees there at Challenge Athletes Foundation, Nico Marco Longo.
Legend,
Who invited me out, Mr. Simplify himself, who invited me out to San Diego to participate in Buddy Bowl. And then and said, oh, by the way, you really should come out and check out this San Diego Triathlon Challenge with Challenge Athletes Foundation. Of course, I had no idea there was like this great mecca of amputees to sport like there was at SDTC. And I went and fell in love and just couldn't believe the, you know, the great people, you and everyone from Challenge Athletes Foundation that brought me in. And you know, got to meet, you know, heroes of mine, like, you know, Scott Tinley.
Yes.
Who said, hey man, this is it. This could be your thing, you know,
yes.
and made it look cool. So, you know, no one there is disabled, you know.
No one,
you know, what is it? Was it Paul Martin's disabled my ass comment?
Exactly. Challenged athlete my ass. That was one of my favorite things. Running Ironman on his prosthetic, and he passed to German athletes. And as he went by, one German guy said to the other one, challenged athlete my ass. That became our motto, man. I love that. So a week after SDTC, I think you ran New York City Marathon. And
yeah, I did. No, that sucked. That was I don't know if anybody's ever done their first marathon, but you always remember that one because you know, I wasn't exactly in an Elvis suit either. I was just trying to get finished with that thing.
By Thanksgiving, you'd pass your physical to go back to active duty. What did it mean to you to get back there? And when you first got back in theater to address your men and how did it meet up to the expectations you had?
No, I wasn't ready. I mean, looking back on it, I just can't believe I did it. I mean, it was probably dangerous for me to do that. I mean, I had some great leadership that said, hey, man, if you can physically do it, we want you to do it. This would be great for you, great for the Army, great for the unit. But it was hard. I mean, it hurt. It hurt every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, my favorite story is being on patrol. We found this town that we flew into, and I wanted to gather some intel, and there was a target house I wanted to look at, so we flew a helicopter in, and all the rest of the guys came as scouts and these Humvees, and, you know, they took over the city, and were, you know, in a friendly way, but at the same time, we were very vigilant, and met with the elders and gave some humanitarian assistance, and as I was leaving, my foot broke, like literally broke in half. And, you know, I had to do a security halt, and everybody kind of halted and, you know, and set up security. Everybody was looking around, making sure it was safe. Out of my backpack, I pull an extra foot, unscrew one, and put another one on. And as I was doing it, you know, the non-commissioned officer that was with me hit me on the side and said, hey, sir, look. And I look up around, and the whole town is watching it with just this unbelievable look on their face, like, they are robots.
Robo-Man, you're Terminator.
So I'm probably pretty famous in that place.
I love that. So you basically switch out your leg while the whole town is watching.
Yeah, no, I straight up took, you know, replaced the foot because it had broken. You know, it's just, you know, that desert is tough terrain.
So you felt an obligation to go back.
Yeah, I really did. I mean, you know, I came home as soon as I got my deployment order, and my regimental commander, you may have heard of him, H.R. McMaster, who's now the...
Yeah.
National Security Advisor for the President. He was my regimental commander. He brought me in and he said, hey, David, you know, I got some great news for you. You know, you've got permission from the Army for you to deploy as my headquarters troop commander. And I thought, wow, sir, this is historic. And like many good leaders I've had in the past, he said, but first, before you say yes, I want you to go home and talk to your wife. And, you know, and I went home and talked to Kim, and she just looked at me and she said, I thought she was going to say no, honestly, but she looked at me and she said, of course you're going to go. You have to go. You'll spend the rest of your life wondering why you didn't go and if you could do it. Go and do it. This is your chance. And obviously it worked out because it, you know, made history.
One of the things I remember when we chatted years ago, you said you had brave rifles veterans. And that was something that resonated when you talked about that from the Mexican Wars and from General Scott. Talk a little bit about that and what that means to you and why that's so important.
Yeah, there's the, you know, in the Army, you know, we have all these things we say, whoa, and, you know, you have all these motivational things to say each other. But, you know, back in the early days of the regiment, you know, on the back of my belt buckle that I still wear today, it says, Brave Rifles veterans, we've been baptized in fire and steel, fire and blood and come out steel. And, And it's one of those things when I sort of felt down or felt sorry for myself, I thought, no, you know, I'm not getting softer. I'm not losing my edge. You know, I've been baptized in fire and blood myself, and I have come out steel. So, you know, you got to pick yourself up sometimes. And even though you know, when most people see me, I'm at the top of my game, but you know, there's some times there where I'm not. And you got to think about those kind of things. And, you know, in the military, we love to give ourselves little mantras like that. So, you know, the Brave Rifles, veterans, I mean, that sticks with me. I'm proud of that. I wear that patch every day.
So after your second tour in 2005, you're back at Walter Reed. And talk a little bit about the, because that's around the time that I think Operation Rebound was launched. Talk a little bit about how all that came about.
Yeah, right. Actually, we started talking about Operation Rebound. Me, Virginia Tinley, and then Jill, and everybody got involved at that point. And it was right before I was deploying. And then when I came back, I was actually brought back by the Chief of Staff of the Army, then General Cody, to build the Amputee Center at Walter Reed, you know, to kind of create a model for what they were going to build both in out in Balboa and then at the Center for the Intrepid. You know, and sort of how are we going to create a center of excellence where we can take young men and women that have been injured at war, get them back physically fit, and if they so choose, return to duty, and like I did, or at least make them, contributing members of society so that they're not just going home broken for someone else to fix them. And it was a great concept, and I was very proud to work on it. And at the same time, it was a perfect parallel with working with multi-sport and equipment grants and everything else, because we had not in the Army figured out yet what people needed and how we were going to pay for it. So, you know, if a guy needed a mono ski, you know, hey, put in a grant to Challenge Athletes Foundation. They'll take care of that. You know, why wait a year and a half for the VA to figure you out? You know, let's get one now. Or, hey, you want to train for a marathon? Let's get you hooked up with a coach, get you out to a triathlon camp, and get you involved in sport and sign up for an event. And, you know, it just sort of, it caught fire. And then, of course, you know, the first Paralympians from our injured soldiers were able to go and start to participate in both summer and winter games. And Challenge Athletes Foundation has been a ride along with them, funding them to go and help as they go and compete for the nation. And it's a natural calling for these young men and women that are injured to say, hey, you know what, I can go and continue to compete and even wear my national colors and international events, whether it be in triathlon or other sports. It's a great opportunity.
So how important was it to go through what you went through in order to, you know, build Operation Rebound? And what did you learn from your experience that sort of outlined and defined what Operation Rebound became?
Well, you know, I have to be careful about it, because you know, you don't want to create a fraternity where everything's okay.
I mean,
the truth is, truth is, a lot of these men and women out there are suffering. I mean, this is, you know, you're talking about taking some of the best of our American people, you know, this population, this unique group of people that are able to make the, you know, make the mental health, physical checks and have it together enough to be able to join our service, go off, get blown to smithereens, become single, double, triple, even quadruple amputees, and then have to start a new life. And, you know, Operation Rebound is more than just giving out a grant to somebody. You know, you're joining an elite membership of people that are interested in getting back to the normal lives. And, you know, we deployed to war as professional athletes. And certainly it's our responsibility to figure out how to get them back there. And if they can't continue to serve in the Army, then we've got to find a way for them to continue to serve in their community. And if a guy is overweight and not moving around and sitting behind a computer all day at his home and you know, mushrooms are growing on him because he hadn't seen the sunlight in a couple weeks, he's never going to make it. And that's going to lead to suicide or something else that's horrible. And we can't afford that. We got to get him back in action. Use my own line.
From your book.
Got to get him back in action.
A lot of people feel, hey, gosh, war's over. The need is over. We don't need, you know, Operation Rebound and programs like that. There's not a need anymore. My feeling is that, you know what, it's not like somebody comes back and they're you know, they still have needs 10 years, 15 years, 20 years later. How important is it to continue the emphasis on our troops and their needs, even if people aren't in the line of aren't in danger anymore?
Well, I think, Bob, you know, I think it's been missed by journalists lately, but I've been going to Walter Reed about once a month since I got back.
Yeah.
And visiting the men and women there. And it's this population of people that got injuries that at the time weren't limb loss injuries that have now 10, you know, even in some cases 15 years later, they've had to self-select to become amputees because their limb salvage for whatever reason did not work or has not given them the activities of daily living that they need. So they've chosen to have an amputation. So we right now at Walter Reed have a number of and at Center for Intrepid and out in San Diego, a number of men and women that are having these elective surgeries because they're, I mean, face it, you look at a guy that's 10 years down the road like me that's stayed in command, run a, you know, a huge number of marathons and half Ironmans and Ironman, and then, you know, there they are, you know, 40, 50 pounds overweight, ambulating with a cane 10 years later on disability because they can't work in a job they want to do. And then there's the possibility of, well, maybe if I get this cut this thing off, I can start over again.
Right.
That's pretty huge. And, oh, by the way, people forget, but, man, we are still heavy in it. I mean, there's a lot of troops still engaged in combat.
Yep.
In Syria and in Iraq in some instances. We just sent a huge SFAB brigade of men to join the fight in Afghanistan. And we have service members deployed all over the world with special forces, as we've noticed recently with the incident in Niger. I mean, the guys are out engaged. So, you know, we do produce, you know, just through training, a number of amputees every year, just from training injuries. And it's unfortunate, but that, you know, we're kind of in a line of work where
yes.
you work with heavy machinery and
yes.
you do some pretty, you know, jumping out of airplanes. I mean, we do some pretty wild stuff. So it's not, you know, we're not playing frisbee at work, you know.
So June 2006, Ironman Coeur d'Alene.
Woo!
Yeah, that was
some cold water.
I know that. I sort of remember a phone call to you basically saying, "Hey, how about an Ironman?" And you were wide open, man. You were. Hey, I'll try. And you jumped in.
I looked at a calendar and I thought, you know, how long is it? You know, I started reading articles, and of course, your magazine and others,
yeah.
and said, "Man, you know, this is possible. You know, I could do this." I went and talked to my boss at work and said, "Hey, I'm bored. You know, I need to do something. I am a goal setter." And he looked at me and he said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, I talked to my friend Bob Bevitt, and I think I can do Ironman." And he was like, "You know, he's great. He's a surgeon, special forces guy." He was like, "Oh yeah, you're definitely doing Ironman, whatever it takes." So. you know, it's rare in the Army to have a job where you can go train 2 or 3 hours a day. But I was lucky and I had that when I was in D.C. working on policy. And they sort of let me have my time that I needed to go train. And so I'd spend an hour in the pool in the morning. I'd ride at least 2 hours a day and I'd run at least, you know, 30 minutes to another 2 hours, as much as I could, as much as my stump could take it. And made it to Coeur d'Alene and did a, I can't remember what my time was.
1355, I know.
Yeah, there you go, 1355. And then realized that it could be done. And I still have to convince family members that I did that, you know, all that running, biking, and swimming in a single day. I think they envision it being a number of different races in a couple of day period.
Well, what I loved about that is when you look at the photo of you at the finish, you're saluting. Right, and I think you stopped a quarter mile or so from the finish, and basically made sure that you had all the made sure your face was clean, and
yeah,
you wanted your men to see you at that finish line, not struggling across the finish line, but looking strong and powerful. How important was that to you?
Yeah, you know, Bob, I had no idea that that there would be banners of that everywhere, and that it would be all over the internet, and it's been incredible, but. What I really wanted to do, it was not about self-glory. It was not about anything. What I wanted to be able to do was take that picture back to my soldiers and say, look, it can be done. I beat this. I'm ready to continue to fight. And what I didn't realize was that my men already knew that. They were proud as hell of me, every one of them. What I had to convince was myself. So once I finished Coeur d'Alene, I knew I could do it. And that's when, you know, I got the slot to Kona.
Yes, you
did. Let's do this.
I still remember coming down Ali'i Drive. I think it was pouring rain.
Oh, yeah, it was pouring buckets.
It was huge puddles, and David's coming towards the finish line, and, you know, families are out there. It's a monsoon going on. Coeur d'Alene is great. It's a great race to do, but there's something special about the Ironman World Championship in Kona, Hawaii. How special was that day for you?
It's one of those things. I mean, it almost didn't happen. Remember, there was the earthquake and
that's right.
Tsunami.
Yep.
Sirens were going off, and they talked. You know, the swim was rough, and I actually vomited at the turnaround. I was floated outside that boat and threw up, and had about 1,000 fish around me for a minute. I've never been as filled with energy as when I got out of the water. I mean, that swim, it's like there's just something to it. All those people out there floating and
yes.
You know, trying to stay up and be close to the front, and then you know the cannon goes off and you take off swimming, and you realize that you're surrounded by the world's most driven people, and it is awesome. And then you know on the bike course, it's a dream. You know, besides, you know, there's a big hill in the middle. It's kind of a heartbreaker.
Yeah.
But as you come back down the mountain, and you kind of take a break, and you're looking around, going, "I'm doing this.
Yes.
I'm riding in Hawaii. I'm in Kona, man. Oh my God." And then you know, I finished. Yeah, I finished my bike. Just as my brother there won, so I got to stand at the finish and watch him cheer him across the finish line as I took off on my marathon.
Wait! Your brother?
Well, you know, Norman Statler.
Oh, your brother
and I.
You guys are buddies.
Together a little bit. I like to say I trained with him, but you know, if you remember, Norman and I went on that ride right, you know, 2 days before Kona, and he looks at me, and he goes. He goes, "Oh, you know, how fast are you going to do this, Dave?" I said, "Oh, you know, I'm thinking I'm going to try to break 13. He goes, "Man, you are a much better athlete than me." I said, "Well, how's that?" He goes, "I could never go and exercise for 13 hours. And I said, "Well, that's one way to look at it as a glass half full, Norman. I appreciate it." But
So how'd you meet Norman?
Yeah, it was through Quota. You know, I was riding
yes.
a Quota bike. He was riding a Quota bike, and Paul Thomas hooked us up, and we got to go ride together. I did his warm-up ride for his victory at Kona.
That was a race he won by, 71 seconds over Chris McCormick. That was a classic.
That's right. He just killed it. Because, you know, the year before, he had a bad wreck and
yep.
bike problems and everything else. So it was awesome. I mean, I'll never forget being outside of Kona. We were going on this great ride, and, of course, you know, everybody's taking pictures of us and everything. I have a great – it's right here on the wall next to me, as a matter of fact. And he looks at me and goes, "Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and ride back in, and we can have lunch afterwards." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I'm good, man. I'll ride back in with you." And he looked at me and smiled. He goes, "Okay, I'll see you at lunch." And, man, he took off. And I've never seen someone become so small in the distance in my life. And even the sag wagon left me. They were like, "All right, see you, Dave." And so, no kidding, I get to the restaurant, join him for lunch, and he's already taken a shower, read the paper, and eaten lunch by the time I got to the restaurant. I said, "Well, I guess you got here a little bit before me, didn't you, Norman?" So.
I love that. How do you exercise for 13 hours? Actually, I remember Bill Rogers, a marathoner, going, "Yeah, you know, 208, 209, but these people who are out there for 5 hours, oh, my God, I could never do that."
Yeah, they're beasts. How do they do it?
How do they do it? It's so ridiculous. So you are going to be back out here. April 7th is Ironman 70.3 Oceanside. We have our CAF Operation Rebound team of athletes. I think we'll have probably 100 or so athletes participating as part of our group, if not more.
Awesome.
It's been a while since you've been here, right?
Yeah, man. I mean, the last time I did a West Coast triathlon was when I was with you, and we did, wasn't it Malibu?
Yes.
We had those big waves we had to swim out in.
That's right.
And,
at Malibu,
I remember
yeah.
swimming out, trying to hold on to you, get out to the waves, and then just got crushed by the waves, but then had a great body surf on the way back in.
See, you become a body surfer. I love that.
that was fun. But yeah, no, I haven't been out to California in a long time, and I've missed it. I mean, I thank God you guys aren't on fire anymore. I mean, y'all have had some tough seasonal weather lately. It's unbelievable. I think about the people of California every day, especially with the mudslides. And I mean, you know, remember that time we were going to do the $1 million challenge, and I met you guys in Monterey, but we couldn't leave Monterey because the fires were so bad.
Exactly.
I mean, it's been tough. So I'm looking forward to getting out there and seeing the great people of California. I mean, there's some wonderful people out there.
When you look back at those early years of when Operation Rebound was just getting going, and now seeing, you know, besides yourself, seeing Anthony Smith and Eric McElvaney, and just seeing what these folks are accomplishing, and I always tell people the real importance is the quicker someone coming back who's had an injury, the quicker they get in the sport, the less chance there is of that spiraling depression. That sport is underrated in terms of a therapy and something that turns people around. When you look back at where it was and where it is now, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, we've lost too many guys to suicide, and you know, when I get out of the Army, I'm gonna start attacking that. I got to figure out how we win that game, because these guys are young.
They are.
They got to live the rest of their lives in these broken bodies, and some people are attuned to it and some aren't. But it's like you said, it's grabbing them right as they come out of the hospitals or while they're at the hospital and say, hey, guys, let's start setting goals. And then really, Bob, what it's tied to is this mentorship. You know, guys like Nico Marcolongo, who run Operation Rebound, I mean, he is a 24-hour, you know, seven-day-a-week guy available to every athlete that he gets involved with. And they use him. And we need each other, and you need that support. And communities have to reach out to these people and say, what do you need? You know, and it's not about, you know, we don't want to create a generation of amputees that, you know, think they deserve everything for free, and you got to make them earn it. But at the same time, sometimes you got to look somebody in the eye and ask them how they're doing.
Right.
And that goes a long way, and mean it.
Right,
you
and
know,
you're
how can I help you?
So what will you be doing? Are you doing para relay? What are you doing on April 7th?
Yeah, I'm still working it out, man. You know,
okay.
I'm definitely want to swim. I love the ocean, and I definitely want to bike. And we'll see. I'm trying to get a good runner to kind of cover down for me.
There you go.
A
little aqua bike is good. A little swim bike done.
Yeah, a little aqua bike is always nice. And you know, there's some of these young boys who like to run. I can't say that you. I know you still run marathons constantly. So. But you know, I actually did have to have a little procedure on my left knee, and they're doing a study on it. I mean, those of us that I think it's Willie that always, you know, he's a winger. He always calls me a hopper.
Right.
And you know, a 220-pound man that hops around his house, you know, he doesn't have his leg on. I mean, it's finally put the wear and tear on my knee where I gotta back it down a little bit, and you know, gotta set some realistic goals for yourself. So.
Very.
But
cool.
You know, I did ski 5 days last week, so I can't complain. I'm still healthy.
I love that. Hey, Dave, it's going to be great to have you back out here. It's been far too long, and been
can't
following.
Wait.
Every time I see something, you're getting another bar. You're getting it, all of a sudden. You're going from major to colonel, and I'm like, now. So wait, what do you become next? Like defense secretary, or what's the next? What's the next step up?
Well, we'll see how it goes. I got to go command a brigade first, and then we'll see what's next.
Love it. David, thank you, sir, for taking so much time. You're always a legend to talk to. And if people want to sign up and be part of Team Operation Rebound, Challenge Athletes Foundation, challengeathletes.org is the place to go. And you can join David. We'll have probably, I think, about, what do we got, a dozen troops who are participating, David, something like that?
I think so, yeah. I think so. Still winners, so we're recruiting those guys, too. So come on out and join me. I'd love to meet all of you. And I tell a funny story every now and then.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. And David will show you all his best body surfing, and he'll do a great Norman Stadler impression for you. Again, we are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, RunCatalina.com, our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We've raised 2,448 grants, totaling $3.7 million to keep challenged athletes like Mr. David Rozell in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbieville.com or on iTunes. And, as always, endurance lives here.